Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Welcome to Outcasts with me, Tim, much shorter in real life, Downey, and David, those can't be his real teeth, can they? Berry. On today's show, we scale the dizzying heights of the Outlander mountain range, braving avalanches and the loss of extremities to find the frozen, yet oddly perfectly preserved body of a stone-cold Outlander favourite. He's been playing young Ian since 2017, and we've managed to catch him before he runs off into the woods again. He is, of course, the wonderful Mr. John Bell. Welcome.
Hello, welcome, Tim. Hi, David. Thank you so much. Good morning.
Absolute pleasure. How are you? How are you in your far-flung climbs?
I'm doing just fine, yeah. Difficult situation for us all, but, you know, I'm doing okay. How about you guys?
Because you're where? You're where right now, John?
I am in Barcelona in Spain with my partner here, locked down, have been for 6 weeks. But spirits are high. I'm doing things that make me happy. That's all I can say, you know?
We aim to make you happy here, don't we, Tim?
Exactly, exactly. And talking of things that make you happy,
we
are going to do what, which has become a tradition, I feel, is to read a scene. Now, this time, we have chosen a scene because, now, I don't know if you know this, but David and I never watch anything that we're not in. So most of these episodes we haven't seen because we're not in them. And I think that's that's quite a general rule. I don't think that's a surprise.
Completely
to anyone.
Fair. Nope.
David suggested this particular scene, and having not seen it, I thought, well, if it's got young Ian in it and Roger, it's going to be a bit of fun.
It's going to be fun. I mean, fun.
It's going to be fun. It's going to be fun. Absolutely. Unless I'm misreading this, which I don't think I am. I think I've hit the nail on the head here. It's going to be lighthearted. It's going to be quite jovial. So I thought what we would do is approach this scene in that vein, unless a massively misread it, and I don't think I have with my years of experience. I think I've really gone down the right route here. So we're going to approach this particular scene. It's a two-hander between young Ian and Roger, and then obviously the stage directions, the painting of the scene will be done by myself, and I'll give you a few little tips.
You're going to take the reins here, Tim. Okay, I like.
I'll take the reins. All right.
Yeah, just to kind of guide you, having not seen the scene, I'm assuming what I'm going to do is almost a carbon copy of exactly what happened on the day. That's just, and that's not arrogance.
I'm coming at this very cold, so I never read these scenes in advance, so I'm going to be relying a lot on your direction.
Absolutely. I think that's fair enough. So, John, it's obviously your scene. Would you like to take your character? Would you like to mix it up a bit? Would you like to be Roger? Give us a Roger.
I think I'll stick with Ian. Because I want to give a bit of my mohawk too.
Oh yes, lovely. That's what I was hoping for. Right. So, Mr. David Berry will give us his Roger. Okay. So here we go. This is scene 45 from episode 508. Mm-hmm. Painting the picture here, North Carolina wilderness. Here we go. So it's on young Ian, reverently placing his hatchet into the air. Basically, I see this as a bit of a comedy of errors. You're doing something sort of Run for My Wife kind of thing. Some people coming in one door, coming out of another door. It's very similar to that, I think.
Yeah, definitely.
As we'll see here. So young Ian is placing his hatchet into the earth, laying down his weapon with an air of ceremony, burying it the Mohawk way. He has no need of it now.
I pray for peace.
Lovely. Wow. And that's real. And that's real Mohawk.
That is real Mohawk from the Mohawk Language Preservation Society. Yeah.
Really?
You learned that?
Mm-hmm.
Fascinating. How much Mohawk did you have to? Did you just learn the bits that you have, or did you go into it a bit more?
I've done a bit of work on the Mohawk language. Yeah, I wanted it to make sure that it came across as best as I possibly can, you know. Mm-hmm. You know, this is obviously something, a culture that we want to celebrate in the show. So yeah, I got in contact with the via some of the First Nation guys that came over in season four. They hooked me up with the Mohawk Language Preservation Society. So I have lots of online resources when it comes to learning this language and understanding the basics of it. So I've done a bit of work, obviously, and yeah, just it's just fun, isn't it? You know, to learn these things.
Do you speak any other languages, John?
Well, I'm here in Spain, obviously, so I've been trying to pick up my Spanish, and it's been going pretty well. I mean, I can ask, do you have hand sanitizer now, which is very important.
That's a must. That's an absolute
must. Who knew that would be a key phrase to use from now on? But here we are.
Fabulous. Now, jumping back into the scene, from afar, Roger approaches. Now, this is where I think it all gets a little bit, this is where the comedy comes in. This is where it kind of ramps up. People don't really know what's going on. I think this, we can have a lot of fun with this. So he spots young Ian.
I'm with you.
And the strangeness of his actions. The burying of the hatchet makes him stop and quietly watch. The ceremony ends and young Ian approaches a small campfire where there is water boiling. So we're building up. So like, oh, what's going to happen here? Young Ian places a dried plant inside the pot, the water hemlock. We recognize the white-looking root, the same as those Claire was missing earlier. So there we go, we're drawing parallels. Roger can't tell what it is. The water hemlock might as well be mint, but he knows the meaning of burying the hatchet from his time with the Mohawk. And that's where the phrase comes from. Burying the hatchet comes from literally burying your hatchet. Is that
literally
correct?
Yeah.
The symbol for not fighting anymore, should have read on. A symbol for peace, but also in this case, for giving up. He has seen enough, he hasn't seen enough, because this is where it all kicks off. Roger approaches, kicks over the pot with the tea, a bit aggressive, but funny, and all the herbs go everywhere. Young Ian, he springs up, he's furious at the interruption.
What are you doing? You didn't ken what I'm doing.
Roger's face tells us that he knows exactly what Ian is intending. Very quietly, almost inaudibly.
I do.
Why? Of all people, why would you stop me? I saw you looking down at the cliff. I ken what you were thinking. You have everything. A wife who loves you, a bairn, and still you didn't want to be with them.
Roger shakes his head, but young Ian presses him further.
When that rope was around your neck and you were dying, what did you see? What did you see in the darkness? What did you see?
That took a bit of a dark turn there, Tim.
I was going to say, do you know what? having read that, I will be honest, for the first time, it seemed a little darker than I, because when it started, I thought, well, this is a bit of fun. Knocking over this, knocking over that. It's a bit Benny Hill.
Yeah.
This is not where I was expecting the scene to go.
No, me neither. I'm imagining it gets a bit lighter, because that's pretty heavy. I can't really see where else it can go.
Right.
But we'll, you know, we can jump straight back in. So we're going to
find the follow on. We will find the comedy in this.
We will. There'll definitely be some. I've worked for many, many years with some of the greatest comic talents, and I know when something funny is about to happen. That's just it.
All right, I'm ready, Tim.
Right, so here we go. So we now jump to 47, which is the follow-on back to that. So after a beat, Roger croaks out the words, his voice still raw from his extended period of silence.
I saw my wife's face.
Young Ian breaks down. I was assuming in laughter, because a lot of people have said that when they'd seen this scene, they had tears in their eyes, and I assume that was from laughter. It may have been a miscalculation on my part.
This is going horribly, Tim.
It's not going what I thought. Okay, we'll plod on. I'm sure there's bits.
Let's push through,
young
guys.
We'll push through. So young Ian, he breaks down, falling to his knees in grief.
Then there's no escape. Even in death.
Roger guesses there must be a woman involved.
What was her name?
Young Ian glances at him, then down at the wampum bracelet, realizing his pain has been discovered.
It doesn't matter now.
Is she dead?
No. But she is lost to me. I only wanted the pain to end, to be at peace.
Roger nods. Young Ian clams up. This is as much as he will divulge right now.
Who can say where your soul might go if you
kill yourself? Roger closes his eyes. The thought is too dreadful to finish.
You might be parted
See, it's just going to always be comedy when I'm doing Roger. I'm trying so hard here. I'm trying so hard to get this scene right. Hold on. You might be parted forever, not only from her, but from all who love you. That's my best effort. I'm sorry.
It's good. It's very good. We're nearing the end of the scene. I'm still a little bit lost to see where the gag is. I'm sure we can get something in. Okay, we carry on. This sentiment aggravates young Ian.
So what now? Go back home? Well, you're a fine one to talk. You buried your weapon, your voice, and now you dare to use it against me.
You're right, I did, and I have to pick it up again and fight. Can you?
I didn't can.
Dig up your weapon and come home with me until you do.
End on young Ian, and I'm assuming you fall over. Or something.
Yeah. Turns around, there's a banana on the ground and he slips. Very comical.
He slips.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then there's a whole big, almost like John Candy in The Great Outdoors kind of scenario.
Yeah. That's, wow. Big rousing canned laughter. Yeah.
Yes. That's what I thought. Well, do you know what? Reading it once again, I remember a very funny story where I walked on set. I was making a film. And one of the runner came up to me and said, have you got the new pages? And I said, no, I know the scene. They said, yes, but we've got some new ones. I went, don't worry, I know what I'm doing. And then they walked me onto set and they said, how are you with tarantulas? And I went, that's hilarious. What? And they said, oh, did you read the new sides? And I said, no. And they said, ah, come over here. And then they led me to a table full of tarantulas of varying sizes, colors, and they then started putting them on me. And it was then wow. I realized, Tim, when they say there are new sides, read them. And I feel I am much like that back in that situation again here, where I should have read the scene first and maybe got a feel of it rather than kind of assume. A very moving scene, though.
Absolutely.
It is a very moving scene. Yeah, it is a wonderful scene. Yeah. This is like the emotional climax of the of young Ian's whole return here, you know? And I'm so happy the way it came out. You know, this was such a generous scene because, you know, we were really allowed to go as much as we wanted, me and Richard at the time, at each other. Yeah. And I can also remember being quite nervous about it because, you know, as you know, it is the emotional moment. But Stephen, the director for us on that block, you worked with Stephen on 07, right?
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah. He was just able to tell me exactly what I needed to hear right at that moment, which was just trust your instincts. You don't need to show us everything, but, you know, trust yourself. And when somebody can really pinpoint and say exactly what you needed to hear at that time for you to get the best performance, it was amazing. So yeah, I was really pleased with that scene. As much as it may not be the cheeriest, I am proud of it.
Good. I mean, did you get much rehearsal for it? Or was it very much sort of, you get there, you're on the day, play it out between the two of you and find something?
Yeah, there was a bit of stunt rehearsal beforehand, which always allows you to kind of feel the emotional intensity where you wanted to go. And then on the day, it was me and Richard, we've been filming for a long time, just us two doing all of our camping stuff. And this scene was coming on later, so we'd already kind of built up what we needed to know so that when we came in here, we came in really just giving it loudy and pulling back or playing with it as much as we could on the day. So yeah, it was a fun day.
Tim, I don't want to make you feel too embarrassed about what just happened here. You completely misread the situation. Yeah. But what I love, one of the things I love most about this scene is how it goes against all our expectations of what we have come to love about young Ian and his return. It should be a real joyful thing. And I think, I mean, there's so many reasons I love this scene. And one of the things I love most about it, as I think we're getting into, is how it forces us to confront these issues of mental health through young Ian. It's like we're placing two opposites next to each other. There's this sort of wonderful bait and switch where we all think that Roger is on this path towards suicide, but then to our surprise, it turns out to be Ian, a character who I think we've typically come to associate, you know, with good humor, optimism, and youth. I mean, John, the smile you give at the end of season four after running the gauntlet, I think has to be up there as one of the most joyful moments in Outlander history.
And that was them just telling me we have one more take left and that's it, you can go.
What's even more interesting to me is that the character himself, Ian, is played by you. You know, it doesn't take much for John Bell to crack a smile. And the meeting of these two opposites, you know, the great depression that young Ian has and joyful exuberance, it's so confronting and surprising. And I think that's exactly the point. You know, mental health is complex. It's one of the biggest pitfalls of suicide prevention. It's how unexpected it can seem, especially in someone so full of life or the person with the biggest smile in Outlander. So I'm wondering, John, what are your thoughts here? Did it surprise you that Ian was having these dark episodes?
Yeah, as you were talking about, you know, young Ian has been seen constantly as this sort of, I would say, someone that just exudes joy, you know, to everyone. And here he is in such a broken place. Now, I think I was talking to my mum about this last night, actually, and we were talking about significant emotional events, you know, and these being the sort of things that can change people or affect people forever. And Ian has gone through so much in his short period of being on the show in his life, that it's incredible that he's actually been able to keep this strong for so long. So obviously whatever happened with the Mohawk, we've not gone into it yet. I'm sure we will eventually learn about this, but that has obviously affected him in such a way that he is no longer able to find happiness. And it's only through Roger does he actually begin to see a bit of light, a bit of hope, you know, which is kind of ironic in a way, because there's Roger being very in his head, also in the same position, but these two men actually finding each other and seeing each other helps them both. And I just, yeah, as you say, I love how beautiful that is.
I think that's one of the really cool things about the scene, is that we don't really understand, you know, mental health. It's very complex. It's something that we really, really can't get inside. And but I would hazard to think that one of the clues in the script is one of heartbreak. It's something I can very much relate to. And certainly any time I've felt down or ever had any experience with like that kind of thing were linked to the loss of someone I love, either through circumstance or death. I remember an acting teacher of mine once said, you can't become an actor until you've earned your first paycheck, you've paid your first rent, and you've had your heart broken. And this scene seems to me to be a lot about heartbreak and those kind of things. And I mean, you've been acting since a very young age. And when did you earn your first paycheck, pay your first rent, and have you ever had your heart broken?
Well, I earned my first paycheck when I was 8 years old, which is pretty surreal to think. But yeah, that was I won a competition to win a part in Doctor Who.
Competition? What did you have to do with this competition?
It was a Blue Peter competition. So I don't know if you know that, David, but you know what I'm talking about, Tim.
I know exactly what you're talking about.
So I have my Blue Peter badge. So this is like a children's television show. And they often partner with Doctor Who. It's on the BBC. Still going. And this year I was at the right age to audition for this amazing competition, which was to win a part actually in Doctor Who for any up and coming sort of young talents or whatever. So I'd entered it, didn't think anything of it. Actually probably was more pessimistic, you know, this will probably go to somebody that knows somebody, but actually no, it turns out they were genuinely looking for somebody and went down, got to the next stage, went down and auditioned with funnily enough, with Annette Badland. She was part of the workshop. Yeah. Because she played one of the Slitheen, which was these monsters in Doctor Who. So she was there.
Did she win a competition too? Is this how all casting is done on Doctor Who? You just have to win a competition.
Must be. And Andy Pryor was there as well. So that was a really amazing experience. And then I ended up winning the competition. And Russell T. Davies was the one who called me to tell me that I'd got the part. And it's so funny because only recently have I been up and actually seen Andy Pryor and talked to these guys again so many years later. And, you know, they were part of the reason why I'm still here. So it's always lovely to do that. So yeah, that was my first paycheck Paid my first rent when I was like 17. Pretty normal.
Wow, not really. It took me a long time.
Yeah, it's good in this day and age. Goodness me.
So you were really happy to get out from under your parents then?
Well, do you know what? It's not that I wasn't happy to get under. I'm sure I was always wanting a bit more independence, but that's just kind of normal teenage things. But my parents had been a part of my career the whole way through, you know? When I was eight, you know, we had to have chaperones and tutors with you on set, obviously. And my mom's a teacher, so she could have been my tutor. So that's what she did. And my dad would take time off work to be my chaperone. So we were really a unit. We worked together, which meant that in this crazy up and down, you know, world, which can be really difficult to navigate as an adult, never mind as a child, when you're not fully understanding the highs and lows of it all, you know? When I would go on set and I was like 10 years old, it was like adrenaline constantly. I loved it. I loved being a part of it. And then you go back to school or you go back to your normal life and it'd be such a dip. And you wouldn't, you know, it's addictive and you wouldn't understand it. You wouldn't be able to kind of wrap your head around it. So that's why I was so lucky to have my parents who kept me real, kept me grounded.
And essentially gave up their careers for you.
Well, yes and no. I mean, they would take time off. So, like, we went to New Zealand to film The Hobbit, and that was like a year of our lives. So they took time off to do that. But I mean, when are you going to get the opportunity to go out and live in New Zealand and make a film like that? My dad's a huge Lord of the Rings fan. So he was like, absolutely, you know, I can, you know, he's a bit of a geek. So like me, I get that from him. And I think it was when I went in for the audition for The Hobbit and Peter Jackson was there. And he was asking me whether he could bring in his Gollum statuette to get signed. And I'm like, come on, Dad.
Stop. Dad will always embarrass you, John.
Absolutely. I love it. Because I was going out there for a year. So they also needed to check that my parents were normal, sane people too, if they're going to be around a lot. Luckily, they are. And yeah, so that's been like, my career is kind of unique up until this point because I've always had these people, nothing to do with the industry, but only to do for my happiness, you know, which has been pretty amazing.
So how have you had time to have your heart broken and all that? Or have you?
I mean, you know, I have been pretty lucky. You know, I have people that I can talk to. I mean, the only thing I can think of is like, you know, when I was 17, you know, as everyone, my grand passed away. But that was a time where I was surrounded by family. You know, and I was surrounded by people I could talk to, which is why it's so heartbreaking at the moment, because you can't be there for people and you know, you can't have these conversations in person. So I was able to, you know, be able to understand what was going on. So that's something I draw on. But I also just think, you know, a lot of things can make you sad. You just need to figure out what that emotion is and deliver it when the time comes, you know?
Dead pets or something? Oh, that what you draw upon, Tim? Your hamster?
On that front, the Downey household is never particularly pet friendly. I think I had a fish once that I didn't even realize you had to feed. And so I found it floating on the surface one morning and was quite unperturbed by it.
I'd had a similar thing when I was a kid. I had a fish, and it didn't take me very long for me to kill it either. I had this idea that the fish needed food, right? And then fish do need food, and parents kept the fish food right next to the fish bowl. And I think just me, I was like, "Oh, fish are hungry. Fish always want fish food." So I kept filling the fish bowl with fish food, and then the fish overate and died. And I remember waking up in that morning, it was probably about three. It's one of my earliest memories. Wow, we're going deep here. And I saw that the fish had died. And it was because of something I did, because I overfed the fish. And I couldn't understand how you could die from overfeeding. But there you go. So my good intentions killed a goldfish.
Bless you. I
never really recovered from that trauma.
I can see.
still reliving it.
Yeah.
And see, when I go to dark places, I really am thinking of that goldfish. But there's a litany of dead pets that followed me after that, much like Tim.
It's a pet cemetery around his house.
Yeah,
there's a dead hamster. There was a dead rabbit. And, we shouldn't get into it. It's just very macabre. Not like this. We should get back to this scene, right? There's no refuge here. But aside from heartbreak, one of the things that, look, there's never a good reason why someone might kill themselves. I don't think we can ever really justify that. But it seems to me another reason that something that's playing upon young Ian here is this issue of change in identity. And it's Ian has undergone a huge change from being a boy in Scotland to becoming a Cherokee warrior.
And really just having no one to talk to about it.
Exactly.
You know?
Yeah.
That understands what he's gone through. Yeah.
And he seems to be, if I'm right here, really in conflict with who he is. I'm presuming the love that he had to give up was over this issue of his identity. You know, Ian wasn't a Cherokee, therefore he wasn't allowed to be with the woman he loved. And because of this, Ian maybe comes to hate his own identity. You know, maybe if he'd been Cherokee, then he wouldn't be in this pain. And I'm wondering what you think of this issue of identity here and of being in conflict with your own sense of who you are, and how do you relate to Ian's pain in this scene?
Yeah, I mean, I guess, well, Ian's pain here is obviously something that has been built up for quite a long time, you know. And I think, you know, we're going through a period now where we are stuck inside and we're not able to fully be ourselves. So I can understand his almost inner monologue, his inner saboteur affecting him in a way, because I'm having to physically fight that too, you know. But I think I think the reason why he just comes so serious is because he has no one to talk to about it. And it's that feeling of being so alone. So it's hard to relate to that because I have always had people around, you know. But I know that's not the case for everybody, and certainly isn't the case for young Ian. So, yeah, it's a tough one. But it's
in your times of strife, who do you turn to on set, or you know, who's that person for you?
Yeah, I mean, well, it is my mom, absolutely. You know, I will go to my mom and I will talk to her about anything, and she's one of those people that you just makes it clear to you, you know. But on set, I mean, if you guys are around, absolutely, I'll be coming to you guys.
I don't think you've ever come to me, John. I think that's a mistake. We don't even know what scene you're doing.
this is it. And unless you're bringing like a tea or a cake, I've checked out already.
And you're already, yeah, you don't care. Fair enough. I mean, yeah, as I spoke about earlier, Stephen was a huge help. He was somebody that really was able to key into what I was feeling and really help me get there. And also, I guess it's also your fellow actor, you know. Here it was with Richard, who absolutely killed this episode. I mean, really in awe of him, especially in this episode. And because of that, you know, you felt that you were getting a good volley with him. You were getting a good rapport. So he was somebody that I really did go to. And he was always really generous, just making sure, you know, giving me a wee wink. That was good. That was good, you know, just to kind of keep your own voices inside your head affecting you too much, you know.
I suppose that's the problem as well, is when you get a scene like this, it's very easy to become very isolated, because it is a tricky thing to do. It's not an outward thing where you get an immediate response. It's such an inward working, and you're peering into that microscope as to what's going on inside someone. It can kind of make you quite insular. You can't kind of take yourself away. You kind of physically move away from a group to kind of find that placement. And I think that could be very, very tricky. And also, yeah, so you need that camaraderie just to kind of just keep you, be it a director or a fellow actor, just to keep you on that sort of straight and narrow, as it is a performance as well at the end of the day, and you need to convey it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think that really relates back again to the issues of mental health this scene brings up. You know, it's like it demonstrates the importance of talking about our problems or having someone to talk to, and just asking someone if they're okay can really make a huge difference, because you never know what someone's going through, even if they'd appear to have everything in order. And I think it's beautiful that Roger is that person, because in many ways he is and isn't the perfect person for Ian to talk to. It's his Ian's frustration with Roger that in turn helps him come to a better understanding about love and loss.
Yeah, and I think it's also, you know, at the end of the scene, you know, there's just that little bit of hope, which I think is something we're all needing at the moment, you know, for Roger to kind of, without saying it, but basically bad times will end, you know, this is not going to last forever. You need to keep fighting. And sometimes you just need to hear that, you know, and I think that's in that moment. Yes, it's the drama of Outlander and it's the huge thing, but what it really comes down to is just somebody telling you the thing that you wanted to hear or you needed to hear at that right moment.
Because we all often look to young Ian to be that character, you know, to give us the hope.
That's true.
I think of all the characters, young Ian is one of the characters, like you said earlier, who we observe undergoing the most physical and psychological change. I mean, he's constantly subjected to these very big life-changing traumas. In like in season 3, like you were captured and raped by
Gators.
Through it all, he seems to maintain this sense of optimism and hope. And like you said, right now the world is in the midst of a pandemic, and I'm wondering, in times of adversity, you know, whether they're on set or in lockdown, how do you cope? Are you able to maintain a sense of optimism yourself, like young Ian?
I try my best to, absolutely. I mean, I think the whole thing is you've just got to find that thing that you got to do every day that just makes you happy, right? That little bit of self-care, whatever it is. I recently got, I think I'd downloaded something, it was like 105 things to do in quarantine that aren't Netflix, you know? So I've been working my way through that, whether it's make a plan or reach out to people and tell them that you're grateful for them or whatever it is for that day, you know? And that's been really helping, actually. Be creative, do something creative, something like that. Practice the best Spanish. That's
my thing for today. Come on, that 105. Were we, maybe
we're 104? You were the title. Yeah, it was 100. Yeah, it was, and then underneath Outcasts. Absolutely.
But it is extraordinary, the parallels, in the sense that you have, your character is isolated within a community where you don't speak the language. Mm-hmm. And you have to kind of learn to kind of find your place within a community whose language is not your native language, which mm-hmm. I think is very fascinating, which is kind of where you are as a person anyway, is you are in and you're isolated to another extent in the fact that what is going on is actually happening as well. So the parallels are actually quite, you know, it's art imitating life in that respect, which is, again, quite extraordinary. Mm-hmm. As my life does not, I haven't become governor of New York. Contrary to popular belief, it's not the case. I do ride around on a horse and wear red a lot. Feel it goes in my eyes. But that's where the parallels end. I probably should start wearing a wig. If the lockdown hairdo is anything to go by, my bouffant, as I'm sure a lot of people are suffering at the moment, it's becoming grandma. My hair goes from it's normal, it's normal, it's normal. Now I'm your grandma. And it's got that kind of slightly bouffony, I could be a mobster in the 50s, that kind of slightly...
It's got a little bounce to it, yeah.
There is a lot of... There's too much bounce, John. There's just too much bounce. And what the bounce does is it creates areas where you're going, what is that? I've never seen that before. These are my daily struggles.
Yeah, I can see. It's been affecting you quite severely.
It's a real thing. It's a real thing because, you know, we're suddenly going to come out of this. And one of the things is we're probably all going to go outside and go, who is that? Massive beard, strange hairstyle. It's going to be very odd. I mean, you're never going to get an appointment in a hairdresser for months.
Yeah, well, the thing that's been giving me a bit of laughs recently has been seeing everybody shaving their head in young Ian style. I mean, that's great. I'm loving this. I'm seeing all these kids get sent their photos. Yeah, trendsetter. Like my son asked for the mohawk, the young Ian look today. It's like, that's so sweet, you know. And that's
this is what happens in isolation.
Yeah,
exactly what happens in isolation. It's
I should be getting shaving myself my mohawk again. I don't know. I thought I quite suited it.
I don't think you should take it off the table. I think it should be. Move it up that list of 105.
105, okay.
Put it in brackets. You know, you can bypass it, but I would always come back to it.
Yeah.
Okay.
Did young Ian make that decision to cut his hair because he wanted to become more mohawk, or was it, what was it about?
I would imagine so, yeah. I imagine it's that sort of, when you go somewhere new, you're sort of trying to join that culture, right? Amalgamate into that culture. So that's why he gets these tattoos as well, which were such a huge part of the change of his identity, the shaving of the head. So it's all very... you know, ceremonial and culturally significant to the Mohawks. So yeah, I mean, it's great because it's a character as well that has always sort of been throughout. There's a lot of bastards in Outlander, you know. So to have
literal
Ian there,
and figured it.
to have Ian be there to be that sense of kind of right and wrong. has always been a joy of playing him. Sometimes it's not the most exciting. Sometimes you want to be the arsehole or the bastard, but being Ian is fun. And certainly getting to explore the Mohawk culture has been such a benefit to this too. Such an amazing experience.
Tim, you can probably speak to that. What's it like being an arsehole and a bastard on Outlander?
it's fabulous. It's fabulous. The doors open is all I can say to that. It's very, very exciting. I'm going to give you a really dull fact. But did you know, just talking about the Mohawk language, but did you know, and I haven't just Googled this, this is something I actually did know,
okay,
is that the American Secret Service during the Second World War used to send their transmissions in, I think it was either Mohawk or Apache, because they were almost impossible to code break.
The wind talkers,
because they were a language that the Germans had never come across.
Oh, really?
So they didn't understand the vowel, the syntax. They couldn't work out how these words were words.
So that's how the Americans.
What about that?
It's definitely not dull, because it was good enough for a movie with Nicolas Cage, Tim.
Is it?
Come on. Am I the only one who's seen this movie? Wind Talkers. Well,
yeah, you are literally, I think, the only person who's seen this movie.
Look, there's a lot of Nick Cage movies out there, and one day I will slowly make my way through all of them. But that definitely is one of them. Look, now that we're talking about Mohawk, and I wanted to circle back around again to this issue of identity, because I think, like, it's something that is really sort of on the forefront on Ian's mind, like, who is he? And I wanted to relate it back to what it means to be an actor. I think as actors, we're often forced into cultivating very separate public and private personas. I'm speaking for myself. I think one of the main reasons I fell into acting was because I've never been entirely comfortable with who I am. I express myself much better through a mask, you know, but putting on a character just gives me sort of an excuse to express my true thoughts and feelings. And one of the things my family and friends really hate about me is that when I'm doing interviews or even this podcast, for example, I seem to slip into this persona that isn't really quite me. You know, it's not the real me. And I have to say, it's led to many sort of mental health issues in my life. I'm wondering if you, John, think about public and private personas as much as I do. How is the John Bell we see on screen any different from the John Bell who's, you know, buying groceries at Tesco or whatever?
Yeah, I mean, of course there's going to be a difference. You know, there's a performative aspect to being an actor and to being that person. But I try to keep myself as real as I possibly can. I mean, it's back to that as well. It's back to being able to have somebody that you trust to be able to go, was that me there? Or was that me being tense? Or was that me, you know, relaxed? And I've been trying to, you know, get a bit more relaxed with it all. So yeah, I mean, yeah, it is a difficult thing. I can understand completely where you're coming from, David, about it being hard to keep reality and keep you when you're in this life and you're doing this business. So yeah, I mean, just have somebody you can try and talk to, I guess. That's why.
You had that with your parents. Your mum was keeping you honest, was she? Or your parents?
Yeah.
They've been there from the day one.
I think she was just very good at, keeping it real, but in that way, in that sense that you can get caught up in the glitz and the glamour of it all and the sort of very addictive qualities to it. But my mum was just very much someone that was so separate from that world, you know. Never part of the industry. So was always very, very aware of I think the big thing was a lot of people would come up to her on set and expect her to be this kind of very crazy stage mum, pushy personality, and she's the complete opposite. So to have that influence in my life has served me so well. In fact, it served everybody well, because she would often become the mum on set and everybody would go to her for advice. I mean, I've caught her, but she's given folk into trouble, you know, before on set. And because she's my mum, she was basically untouchable, so she could get away with it, you know? So I love that about her. And
what kinds of things is she saying here?
I don't know if I can say.
Please, we all know.
There was a very it was a big film that I did, and sometimes you know we can get caught up in the hierarchy of a film set because everybody's got where they are and so my mom was always thought that this kind of is bullshit. You know, we're all a team here. That was one of the big things she taught me, that you know, the person that is what every single job on a film set is important. And you should never be thinking because you're the actor, blah blah blah, that you are above anybody else. If you miss one part, the whole machine doesn't work. So when she saw stuff like that, injustices going on, people maybe not being given seats or whatever, she would call out. Now, it's not my position to do that, because you know we're working on what we're doing. Call out stuff when you can, absolutely, but. She just taught me to keep it real, and I appreciate her 100% for that.
Has that carried on with you in your life? Are you calling people out on set, John?
No, I'm usually the one that's getting called out, let's be real. I've had a few dirty looks thrown at me for Katrina. Behave. Haven't we all, though?
Well, it says here, the apple never falls far from the tree.
Yeah.
I feel. I was going to say, no, my mother is very similar. My mother is... of a very similar cast in that sense is that she's very sort of blunt about things, but what she has given me is a work ethic. She was the hardest working woman I've ever met in my entire life, hardest person I've ever met in my entire life. And it's interesting how that kind of imbues within you. I've spent a lot of my life kind of repelling certain elements of my parents, kind of thinking, oh God, I'm not like that. No, I will not be like that. I will not be that. And then you find as you get older, actually those things you repel are actually quite almost virtues. And I think, no, the work ethic of just kind of get on with it. My mother, for instance, when I said I wanted to be an actor, said, well, why don't we just ring Kenneth Branagh? I went, mother, you cannot ring Kenneth Branagh. Oh, I'm sure I can. No, honestly, you really shouldn't. I'm doing it. Don't ring. And she did. She rang his theatre company and said, my son wants to be an actor and he wants to do work experience with you at your theatre company. They were doing Hamlet at the Barbican.
Uh-huh.
He's, you know, 14 or something. He'd like to come and do work experience with you. How would that be? And I didn't hear anything. And then a letter arrived from Kenneth Branagh saying, yes, we'd love to have him. Signed Kenneth Branagh. And I think it's those certain elements that parents give you, especially when they don't really know what the business is. And we kind of know that there's sort of like, well, you can't say that to that person because of what you're saying is the hierarchy.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Whereas mums especially kind of think, oh, that's bullshit.
Oh, shit. Exactly.
Let's go and do this. No, it's very simple. This happens and this happens. I don't understand what you're talking about. Let's just try it. And sure enough, you know, more often than not, it's actually a really good thing because people respond to it. People actually quite like, oh, okay, well, I respect the fact that you've called me up and asked for this, or I respect the fact that you've called me out on set. You know, it's those elements that I find fascinating.
Oh, that's so funny, Tim. I'm glad we've both got that kind of...
Yeah.
I love that.
Yeah, well, I think what we've all got in common is mothers, you know, that who all adore us. I think if we didn't have that, we'd probably be different people. One thing you can always count on, if you're lucky, that your mother's going to believe in you. I think I was at a stage just before auditioning for drama school, where I wasn't even going to be an actor. I'd sort of given it up. I was doing this other career path, and it was my mum who actually filled out the application for me and sent it in, because I had already told her I didn't really want to do it. But she said, no, you've got a talent and you should pursue it. And I did. And I think had she not done that, I probably would have been doing something else now. But she did not enter me in a competition and she did not ring Kenneth Branagh. I still had to... do that audition and get in. Parents and people, someone you can rely on and to talk to through hard times is definitely something that I can relate to too, because my mum has always been there through the really tough times. If ever I've had something go wrong in my life, the first person that I think of calling is mum. She's often always the last person I call at the best of times, though. But when something is wrong, I'm definitely calling my mum.
I think I would have to say the same thing. It's my mother. But the same for me, as you were saying, is that she probably is the last person within that group. She will give the best advice. And be the most straightforward. It's the most practical advice. I think one is so easy to overcomplicate things. and kind of think, well, what about this, and think of all these other aspects, when actually the simplest solution is often the best. And that's what the advice my mother always gives. We'll just kind of go, we'll just either just do it or don't do it.
Yeah.
Well, I go and tell him or don't tell him. You know, there is kind of like very Yoda-esque. I've just realized that she's sounding do or not do. That is the way. Although it doesn't look like it. She's a very beautiful lady. She doesn't look anything like Yoda. But I think it's definitely that aspect of that. Which is vital. And wonderfully, my wife has a very similar attitude to things. Of go, we'll just go and do it. Don't sit and procrastinate. You can sit and procrastinate forever and just talk about it and plan things. You can do that forever. Mm. Go, try it, do it. Do it now. Learn on the thing. Learn while you're doing it. You'll work it out. You know, it's fine. And I think that's invaluable, especially in these times of great change. I think our natural actor instinct of it's constant change. We are all in a world of constant change as actors, because no matter what job you have, it will end. And you know that instinctively. It's not as if you're going to work in a big company that will be there for 150 years and you probably your place within it, as long as you work hard. You could be the hardest working person in the world, but as an actor, the job will end. Mm-hmm. It's that aspect. So our adaptation to change could well be more attuned, because it's what we've had to do anyway. Mm-hmm. It's kind of in our DNA, is that you will reach the end and it will change. And after that end, it's uncertain. You don't know when the next job is. You don't know when that will appear. You have to make provisions thereof. There are so many aspects to an actor's life that is kind of not perfectly suited to a pandemic. I don't want to say that, because that sounds odd.
Yes.
Because, you know, we haven't all been like, every actor's not going, oh, the pandemic I've always been waiting for. But I think...
Wrong. Wrong. I have had that thought, Tim. I have thought, I am so well primed for this. A life of uncertainty, not knowing what the day brings, not knowing what to do with my days, having to think of 105 things to do other than watch Netflix. I was like, the world is just kind of... My life in writ large right now. I mean, not to diminish what people are going through. I don't mean to be flippant about that. People are going through some really tough times right now. For the people who are kind of in this privileged position that we are, that the worst that we have to worry about is kind of waiting it out. That's not without its challenges too. And I think that as actors, we, like you said, we don't really know what our next job is going to be. A lot of the time, an actor's life is spent waiting rather than working.
Yeah. And you kind of, you have to accept that, you know, you have to accept that this is going to be such a major part of what you do. But hopefully that this will end. Just kind of like, you've got to accept now what we can't do is for the greater good, but it will end. And yeah,
we'll go through with a blind hope that at the end, you know, there's going to be that job. There's going to be that role. I guess out of that slump and then that waiting.
Yeah, when I finish the job and I go and order some Vivienne Westwood, that is blind hope that I will have another job to pay the rent.
Yes.
I find it particularly interesting as it relates to your own life, as someone who began as a child actor, having already experienced so much in your life. Do you feel like you have more growing to do? Do you have more lessons to learn? Do you have more ambitions on where your career is going to go? I mean, you've already achieved so much. What are your ambitions moving forward?
Oh, it's a good question. I mean, when you were doing it as a kid, you weren't doing it because of your, I don't know, you were ambitious, but that wasn't some driving factor. You were doing it because it was fun, you know, and it was something you really enjoyed. So I think that's always what I've tried to keep doing and keep going. And it's just, if I'm having fun and continuing to do what I do, then that's where I'm at. That's where I'm great. But it doesn't mean that I haven't had really doubtful moments in my career as well. You know, it looks like I've done this whole big thing and I've worked from 8 till now. But when I finished The Hobbit, I had a period of time where I didn't work at all for about 2 years. All the auditions weren't going anywhere. I was feeling like I was stuck in this very weird stage where you're trying to cross from being a child actor to an adult actor. You're too old for the young roles. You're too young for the old roles. People don't necessarily treat you as seriously. And I was really doubtful. It was really dark for a point. And I ended up signing up to university, getting my student accommodation. I was going to give up acting. I was going to do it all. And that's when Outlander audition came through. And I auditioned for that and ended up getting that, which put me on a bit of more of a positive streak again. So yeah, that's something, you know, you have to deal with. But
your headshot, when we do the read through, always comes up, and it's got this headshot of John Bell.
I know.
His glorious golden hair. He looks very angelic. And it's like, if you gave that headshot to me right now and said that this was you and you're auditioning for a part and then you came in, I would be very angry as a casting director. This is not you. You can't come in and audition. You have grown through this series. It's been, what 3 years you've been on the show, right?
Three, four years.
And you've changed as an actor and as a man. How has the show changed you, and what have you learned from it?
Yeah, I mean, that was the big thing I was talking about, that kind of change between child to adult actor. This is the benefit of doing Outlander, because he really has gone from boy to man. And to be able to not only have the joy of playing that, but for it to also be permanently a part of a piece of art that I can go back and watch whenever I want is incredible. I think it's, you know, part of the joy of film and what we do. I mean, I haven't actually done a lot of stage, but stage seems to be this sort of magical moment where it happens and then it will never happen again quite the same way. Whereas film is now permanently there for the rest of your life. So it's part of the reason why I love it so much, because it has captured me at different times in such a unique way.
Yeah. I don't know about you, Tim, but I look back on my work from like 10 years ago and I just cringe. I can't.
I think there'll be, I agree, but I also think that there'll be a moment, give it about another 40 years, and you will look back and you will see yourself and you'll go, God, I was actually really good. Or, God, I was actually pretty good looking. Didn't realize it at the time, but goodness me, I haven't seen that waistline since 2030. You know, that kind of thing. I think it will then start to have a different, you know, view to it. As I always think, it's always worthwhile being proud of kind of every step, because every step has moved you on to the next step that you are on, and it was that trajectory that's kind of taken you. I mean, don't get me wrong, there are certain things. I remember doing an episode of a show which was a guess the ending, where it was Terry Wogan. I don't know if you know Terry Wogan, mm-hmm. David. Very, very famous sort of talk show host. Irish talk show host, Terry Wogan. Mm-hmm. Brilliant. He was brilliant. Not that impression. He was brilliant. And he would present this show, and I had to have an affair with a teacher, and I must have been 17 at the time. And I was having an affair with a woman who was in her late 30s. And I thought I was very intense. I thought, yes, I'm an intense actor. What an intense performer I am doing this. And then I remember, and then basically it was like a phone in where people at home had to ring in and say, does he have the affair? And go, there was me on a train station holding flowers in the rain. Yes, that's it. Do I get on the train and leave, or do I stay and the affair continues? Quick game for you. What do you think the great British public chose? Do I get on the train and leave, or do I stay and have the affair? What do you think they chose?
Stay and have the affair, no?
I mean, that's what I'd vote for, but I'm pretty sure that they voted for you to get in that train, Tim.
John, you're absolutely spot on. The great British public voted that I have the affair.
What a salacious which
was
fabulous. Bunch.
And then the last shot was me on like the Late Show being interviewed for my latest book, which there's a much older man, was my tale of having an affair with a much older woman. Fabulous. Fabulous. I don't know how we got around to that, but no, yes.
How fantastic.
And so I remember watching it about 2 years after that came out. I went, this is, oh my God, this is embarrassing. I'm surprised more people didn't speak up at the time and go, this is terrible. And now I look back on it and kind of think, oh, look at my lovely hair. What lovely hair he had. Look how young he is. Look what he's doing. So there's a real warmth now that I have for that younger version that has kind of, that was the Rosetta Stone that has then kind of translated out into what you now become or what you now present. So I think it's all, you know, I look back.
I guess what kind of intrigues me though is when was that made, Tim? Do you know roughly
1998.
Right, okay. So
something like that.
The whole like maybe social media and stuff like that hadn't been a huge, wasn't even thought about.
Yeah.
Which is something I think is really interesting when we are as actors now, is that we're talking about the online presence in this sort of, which is an amazing tool, but it also means that you read a lot of comments about your performances, which you probably didn't need. You never did back, you know, your own opinion and the opinion of the people you worked with are the ones that counted. And now we read a lot. And that's a big thing that I worry about with my mental health, is that I try to, I remember I worked with an actress once and she told me that she lives in this bubble. And this bubble is a bubble of positivity, and that everything she reads is something nice, and no matter what, she lives here. And I kind of liked it in a way. And so now, but because I know that when you are a person like an actor who is very aware and wears their emotions on their sleeve, you know, is upfront, comments that are pretty negative and that can hurt you. So it's something that I've kind of been working on recently, is just, does, first of all, does this opinion matter to me, you know? And if it does, is it worth listening to? Is it critique, you know? Or is it an opinion that I can just go? And I think that's something that I'm working on and learning on personally for me that has been an issue. I don't know how you guys have felt about that.
I think one of the best things I heard with regard to criticism is don't take criticism from people you wouldn't take advice from. That relates a lot to the punters out there just giving their own opinions, because everyone's got an opinion, and it's the people that you really need to listen to that you need to understand where to take criticism from and how to interpret that criticism. Because I think that a very important part of being an artist is, I don't believe that you can just live in a bubble. I think you have to be responsive and sensitive to the world. Otherwise, you're just kind of in an echo chamber and performing to yourself, and becomes very indulgent. I think you have to be open to other people's opinions and be receptive to criticism. But the way that you receive that criticism is really important. Drama school taught me a lot about that. And I don't know what it would be like when I'm thinking back for you, John, going through as a kid and doing all your tough lessons, learning them as a kid, getting those critiques at a very like impressionable age, and having to deal with people telling you what they thought of you and your artistry as you were in fact trying to discover it on your own.
Yeah. I mean, it makes me think of a story that I often tell, which is when I was, after I'd filmed the Doctor Who, I'd had a couple auditions before that where everything was going great. I was getting auditions. I was winning the auditions, blah, blah, blah. And my parents were like, if he's going to continue doing this, he needs to learn quickly the harsh reality of what this career is going to be, which is a whole lot of rejection and a whole lot of critique. So I'm not the greatest singer or dancer. So my parents decided to take me down to audition for Mary Poppins on the West End, right, knowing full well that I was not going to get the part. I couldn't sing, you know, and went down, did the open audition. They went, cool, thank you so much, see you later. Left. That was a trip from Glasgow all the way to London. My parents took me for this. And I kind of turned to them and went, all right, cool, when am I going to hear back? You know, my dad's like, oh, you did, you know, you didn't get it. And I just start bawling, start crying my eyes out. Because this is like, you know, 9 years old, not fully understanding everything. I think they hate me, blah, blah, blah. My dad's like, look, this is the, you know, kind of tough love, you know. This is your career. This is what you are choosing to do. You don't have to. You can do something else. We can go back to what it was normally. Do you still want to do it? And through the tears, I said yes, you know. So that was a lesson I was taught very early on. That doesn't mean that it's always been easy to lose jobs or not quite get there, but certainly was a great lesson to learn.
Yeah, I think dealing with rejection is definitely harsh, one of the things that that we as actors is one of the biggest mental health challenges for us. Tim, do you remember what your first experience of rejection was? Mm.
Do you know what? No, I don't. I actually don't remember, because there's been a lot of it, to be perfectly perfectly frank. So they all kind of meld into one. But I remember. I don't know what I do remember is I remember the sea change between it being personal, feeling personal, I'm feeling this is, it's because I can't do it, or I can't do this and I can't do that. But I remember the sea change where I just kind of went, okay. And I that was the biggest growth period I think I've ever had at any point in this career, was realizing that it kind of doesn't matter. It isn't about you. It's about how you look, or how you fit in, how you might not look like the other characters that you have to look like, or there's a multitude of other things. Almost very rarely, if you're good at what you do, it's not about how good you are, which is the one thing you worry about as an actor, going, well, I'm not good enough to do it. I don't have the talent, or I don't have the whatever it is. It's almost, that's one of the last things. It's, do you fit into the group? Can you do this? Do you look like this? Are you the right age? Are you all of these other things? And as soon as you kind of gather that in and just kind of go, okay, you just move. Okay, fine. Just move on. Fine. I just shrugged that off. And now I'm going to think about what I'm going to have for dinner. Like, and that was the most refreshing thing. Is it just,
I love
weight, the lack of mental health kind of worry about then brooding over it. So then the next time that next audition comes around, you're then thinking, oh God, it's really got to be. It's like that thing in all auditions of going, they can taste your fear. If you go in and going, hello, oh, hi, yes, hello. They're going to go, not you. Absolutely not. I can't spend 6 months with that coming at me all the time. So I don't remember the first time that it happened, but I remember that change where it then didn't matter.
Yeah, I think as an actor, you really have to build up this resilience. And I think that's maybe what I was harking back to, this situation. We have to build up a good sense of coping with, you know, this kind of uncertainty and adversity in our lives. And maybe it primes us pretty well for this situation now, this uncertainty, maybe not. We're not like we're Navy SEALs or anything. We're probably not the best at dealing with moments of crisis. But I remember an acting teacher once said, I think it was Larry Moss, that said that as an actor, you need the heart of a lion and the hide of a rhino. So you need to have that, you know, vulnerability, that huge vulnerability, but also that capacity to shut out the negativity. I'm sure that building up that resilience was something that I don't envy in you, John. I don't know how you came to that at such a young age, but you seem pretty well adjusted. So my question to you is, when are we going to stop calling your character young Ian? How much more growing up is there left to do for this young man? Can't we just call him Ian now?
He's still got a whole lot of story to go. Let's hope we get to tell it. But yeah, I think I like young Ian. Keep him young.
Keep got him plenty young.
Plenty of time to get old. He can still be young Ian for now.
Not old, I mean, and cynical and bitter.
Yes.
Brilliant. Well, John, this has been an utter pleasure, I have to say. Thank you so much for being so open, so honest, and for giving us your time this morning. I assume from where you are, it's glorious sunshine, and we're keeping you from a balcony.
You know what? It's actually been absolutely pouring it down recently, which is not like Spain, but finally some sun today, so that's good. I will be enjoying a bit of a balcony recently. But thank you so much as well for having me. It's been a pleasure. Well, I know we're not, I know we're not saving lives or doing anything like that at the moment, but if we can make someone's day a little less boring, and I guess that's what we can do.
And in Mohawk, what do we got? Come on, you give us a thank you in Mohawk.
I would say I would just be Skinungoa, which just means may the great peace be with you. So,
well, I'm going to say that to you. Skinungoa to you, John, and thank you.
Thank you, guys.
Hello, and welcome to the part of the show. We plumb the depths of our inbox to find the best question that you, our wonderful listeners, have sent in. This one is from Bernard. Hello, Bernard. Wales.
Hi, Bernard. Hi, Bernard.
He asks, "Dear David and Tim, I have recently learned Klingon to quite a high level. What alien language would you most like to learn? I am now trying to learn Elfish." Well, thank you, Bernie. That's a very tricky question. I'm trying to think of, alien languages that I would love to learn. Klingon, obviously, is the classic. The language of the Mysterons might be one. I mean, personally, I would just quite like to learn French.
Yeah, well, I've spent a lot of time trying to figure out
the Scottish accent, which I think is a bit of an alien language myself. One day I'll figure out what the hell they're saying.
Absolutely. And of course, the language we'd all like to learn is the language of love. I think we could all learn from that.
I believe there is a word for that in Klingon. Perhaps, Bernard, you could write in and tell us what that is.
It's a very guttural language, quite phlegmy.
And it's very similar with Scottish, apparently. The way you say I love you is like, I love you, or something like that.
Well, thank you, Bernard. I hope you find a mate that will enjoy the Klingon language with you. And maybe there'll be some little Klingons running around. We can all hope for that. What a wonderful sight that would be. Very, very big foreheads, Klingons. Thank you, Bernard. Thank you for listening to Outcasts.
Please remember to rate, subscribe, and leave a review, as it all helps.
Follow us on our Instagram page at outcast.podcast for all the latest updates.
Or you can send us an email at outcastspodcastshow@gmail.com.
Every week, we shall select a question from one of our listeners to answer on the show.
The theme music is composed by Kieran Ledwidge. All views and opinions expressed on the show are our own and have no affiliation with the series of books written by Diana Gabaldon, or the Sony Stars television show Outlander.
No animals were harmed in the making of this podcast. Although I did have a ham sandwich earlier, so.
See you next time.
See you next time. This episode deals in part with issues of mental health. If you or anyone you know has been affected, then do please get in touch with a doctor, healthcare professional, or mental health hotline.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.